Doctor Who fans across the cosmos, and welcome to another episode of Who Corner to Corner. I'm Paul, and I'm here with my mummy friend, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. How are you today, my friend?
Are you my mummy?
No, wrong story, mate. Wrong story. You're close. I like the way you're thinking, but let's go back in time to the golden age of 1975. Yes, indeed, my friend. The next classic story to go under the Who Corner to Corner spotlight does feature mummies, but not the ones you're thinking of. No, indeed. These mummies are menacing Martian mummy robots. In fact, this story features a great deal of organ bashing and an ancient foe who symbolizes death itself. It's one of those stories that has been hailed as peak Doctor Who by many. The height, you might say, of the golden era, or the Hinchcliffe years, just to be a little bit more prosaic about it. It's a massive favourite of many fans, both old and new. Yes, it's Pyramids of Mars, featuring Tom Baker as the Doctor and Liz Sladen as Sarah Jane Smith. But I wonder, having watched this quite recently, how well does it stand up today? Who knows? And is it worthy of its legendary status? Let's discuss that and other topics relating to the story, and maybe other things as well, as we continue our podcast, eh? Because we do sometimes get a little bit sidetracked, don't we?
Just in case anyone was wondering, I am still here. I haven't walked off.
No, not yet. He's about to, because you can see that. You know.
Did you write that intro, or have you just winged
it? I did scribble. I basically took it from the Twitter, from the Facebook post that I put out, and then embellished it slightly, as is my wont, as I do that
your
sometimes.
Way, yeah.
You know.
Let me give you a little bit of backstory here. So we wanted to do another Classic Doctor episode, and so we... We picked a couple of episodes between us, didn't we, that we liked from Tom.
We couldn't really decide, could we, which one we should do, because we thought we do need to do another Fourth Doctor, because we just haven't done one for ages. And the trouble with the Fourth Doctor stories is there's so many of them, and a lot of them are so really, really, really good, and they're very different from year to year. So out of that 7-year period, where do you start? Which ones do you pick?
Yeah.
So we just put it out to the poll, didn't we?
Yeah, so we picked what we liked, and then we put it out to a poll. And like you say, whittling it down to what we were going to do was very difficult, really, because, there's so many good ones.
I have quite special memories of this one, but let me throw it over to you first, Mr. Jeff. You know, what are your thoughts, initial thoughts, without going into too much detail, because we'll talk about detail as we go. Overview. What is your overview of this?
So I don't think when we go back through these episodes, we need to do a sort of particular plot
breakdown.
That's
not what I asked you.
And everything. No, but I'm
Did
getting
I ask him that,
you
listeners?
Asked me.
No, I didn't. What's your thoughts? Straight out with it. Come on. Now, go. You put me in charge of this episode, and you're going to rue the day, my friend.
Yeah. I'm already there.
I am the boss now. You will do what I say.
So... anyone who listens regularly might know, I quite like a bit of spooky Doctor Who action.
Dude, don't you? Yeah.
And this is not spooky per se, but it's very influenced by sort of universal horror, the mummy and stuff like that, as you know, happened a fair bit during Tom's era, I think. And also a Big Finish do it's actually a huge amount of kind of spooky gothic horror Fourth Doctor audio adventures.
Because they're good on audio, aren't they?
Things like Cloisters of Terror and Silent Scream and stuff, they work brilliantly. I really like this episode. I will admit I haven't watched it for a while, but the kind of sort of spooky horror type feel to it is right up my street.
Thought it might be.
When I was younger, I used to have this book at home that I think my mum got, and it was about Egyptians and, Tutankhamun and stuff. And I'll be honest, they used to freak me out with the gold masks and the long chins and, the painted eyes and stuff like that. But so that kind of imagery has always been quite striking to me, but also the sort of thing of the myth that, you know, those aliens involved with Egyptians, and, you know, the pyramids are so, you know, straight that, like, that they couldn't have been built at the time and stuff, and by their technology, and you know, suppose
it's what slave labor can do, though, isn't it?
And suppose
there's aliens. No, it was literally thousands of people being worked to death in a very short space of time.
It's the way the rock is cut and stuff. Apparently, you know, can't be done. You know,
yes,
and then there's shut
tools.
Up.
Called tools. We have opposable digits, which gives us the ability to craft tools so that we can use those tools to make massive, great big blocks. And we also have the ability of mathematics as well. The Egyptians were very good at maths.
Talking of tools.
Oh, did you hear that, listeners? I'll have you know this has been recorded live. Yeah. Come on in. Yeah, go on. So space aliens, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, suppose hieroglyphs with weird little creatures in and stuff like that. So
yeah, you mean their language, right? The pictorial written language that was developed over a period of years.
No, have you never seen the you know, images of strange alien type things and stuff like that.
Yeah, on for the Egyptians specifically.
In tombs and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not space aliens, mate.
Well, anyway, if you agree with me, and you
I'm
also think the Earth is flat, then do tweet in and let me know.
hold on a minute here, right? So you're saying that I'm a flat earther because I don't believe that Egyptian hieroglyphs depicted space aliens. How does that even work?
No, hinting.
Isn't that kind of the opposite? You think they're space aliens and you're a flat earther, or is it? I don't know.
No,
it's
I don't know.
Not
I just,
the other way, is it?
I just thought about flat earth and nutty conspiracy theories. That was all. So,
mate, the world is a disc carried on the back of four giant elephants who walk across the back of a massive space turtle.
That's it, yeah.
Everybody knows that's a fact. So you like this one, Pyramids of Mars?
Yes,
I do like it.
It's good. So, cool. How about for yourself?
Well, I have a weird history with this one because I have a kind of love hate relationship with it. When I was very young, when I started reading about Doctor Who behind the scenes and all the stories that I hadn't seen, and I was reading Target books and everything else, and actually I didn't read Pyramids of Mars until quite into the 80s, so midway through Peter Davison's kind of era, really. It was just one that my library never had. It was never in the bookshops, and I'd never read it, and I'd never seen it, obviously, either, so I had no idea. But I'd heard so much about it, a lot about it. So, you know, when I started reading up on the show's history, and you read all the, the Peter Haining books and some of the fanzines and stuff that I used to get, and Doctor Who magazine, there was always something about Pyramids of Mars somewhere and all of that. And there's always this kind of this sort of worship of it, that it was like the best thing since sliced bread. It was like the ultimate Doctor Who story. It was brilliant. It was fabulous. And I was quite excited by it because I'd seen some of the pictures from the show as well. And, you know, it did look pretty stunning. Like you said, all the Egyptology stuff, the imagery. And I was kind of into that, you know, not massive into it, but it was one of the things that sparked my kind of curiosity and interest as a kid. So, you know, there was definitely a bit of intrigue towards it. But as I said, I didn't read it until somewhere in the mid-80s in a rainy week in Blackpool on holiday, because we used to go on holiday at Blackpool, you know. And I think I might have bought it from the Doctor Who exhibition, because I used to go to the Doctor Who exhibition pretty much every time we went to Blackpool, and I would usually get something. And I'm pretty sure this year I picked up Pyramids of Mars, that version in the red up there somewhere, if you can see that, our YouTube listeners. I'm pointing to a Target novelisation by Terence Dix, and I kind of read it. I was actually kind of bored by it. I liked all this. There's an opening chapter, like a prologue, which describes the Assyrians or Assyrians and their backstory. And I loved all that because that was proper space science fiction-y type stuff. So I thought that was great. And then when the action kind of cut to Earth, I thought it was a little bit more prosaic. It's like, well, robot mummies, yeah, whatever. You know, Sutek, okay, so yeah, whatever. And then I started questioning things like why, because there's a whole thing about Sutek is imprisoned in this pyramid, right? And he can't move. He's paralyzed. His brother, the sirens, have kind of put him there, yeah. and he can't move because of this radio signal that's been sent across from the pyramids on Mars, right, from the Eye of Horus. And then I started thinking about that, and I thought, well, how does that even work? You know, cause, so it's another example of the science getting in the way of the story for me, because someone will probably point this out if it does actually work, but I don't think it does. And then I kind of started thinking, well, if they had the technology to do that, why wouldn't they actually put the pyramid on Mars, on the moon, or something like that? You know, something that's a little bit closer to Earth, but still equally unreachable for, you know, without space travel and stuff. Why would you put it on Mars? Because the orbit of Mars would take it at some point on the other side of the sun, you know, and it's at different distances and everything else. And it is literally just using radio waves. It's there in the script, in the book, right? It just uses radio waves. So my head is just going round and round and round. And as soon as something like that slots in, the whole story just kind of falls apart for me. So to cut a long story short, I didn't really like it from the book. And then it was one of the first VHS, Doctor Who VHSs that I saw. And was it later in the 80s? And what they did in those early releases, they squashed all the episodes together and cut out the opening and closing credit sequences.
Oh, really?
And oh, my God, I was really bored by it. And because I don't think a lot of these stories work as a continuous piece. They're not written that way. They're not structured as a sort of 2-hour movie or an hour and a half movie,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
They are 4 23-25 minute episodes, and that's how they're written, you know, and filmed and everything. And plus they take a few scenes out anyway to try and get it into 100 and whatever minutes it actually was or something. And again, I was really, really bored by it. So it was a bit of a letdown. I quite liked it up until the end of part one, where, you know, the servant of Sutek appears with the space mask and everything, and puts his hands on Ibrahim's shoulders, and all the dry ice comes out. So I quite like that. But again, after that, I thought it's a story that goes downhill.
Really?
So, yeah. I'm sorry. It's just, and I think also I'm not a massive fan of that kind of melodramatic style of Doctor Who. It's okay. I don't dislike it. It's just not my favourite, you know. So I've always had this sort of. But then there are other times when I watch it, and I'll kind of enjoy it. And I watched this most recently just before Christmas, and I watched it one episode at a time, and I left a few days in between each episode, and I found myself raving for it at the end. I thought, do you know, it's the first time I've watched Pyramids of Mars and really, really, really just enjoyed it. Because
right.
I didn't let all the you know, some of the guffy stuff get in the way of it. I just sat back and just watched it for what it is. And I think for what it is, and considering everything that happened in actually getting the story out there in the first place, it's actually really, really good. And it struck me as well that this is probably one of those stories that if you were to take this script literally as it is right now and do it as they do, you know, just slot it into Shooting Outwards next season, for example, or something like that, right? Whoever, whatever modern Doctor, you could just film it again exactly as is. It would be the same story, and it would be just as good, probably. You know, it wouldn't be out of place, and I think that's one of the great things about Pyramids of Mars. It is one of those stories that just seems to tick all the right boxes, and you know, it's not special in so many ways, but it is really special, you know, because it is just. I think it actually probably is one of the most perfect Doctor Who stories. You know, shaky signs. Doesn't really matter. Just give us loads of giant mummies, loads of deaths, you know, the Doctor being really clever, and then a battle with a really nasty bad guy with a great voice at the end.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What more do you need?
So yeah, that's quite interesting, really, because, you know, I would have thought, you know, looking at its general fan consensus and some of the comments that we'll get to in a bit that we've had from people about it, and the, you know, response to this, you know, tell us your thoughts on it thing. You know, it's really, really popular. I'm not sure where it came ranked in like recent DWM polls.
Oh,
and
I meant to have a look, actually.
Yeah,
but
the recent one, they only listed the top 10 in the end, which was mostly Moffat Epps, wasn't it? I don't know where it came in the last sort of full 200, you know,
it's
ranking.
Usually
or whatever.
It's usually quite high, isn't it? Yeah. It's usually.
But what you said that, you know, so a couple of thoughts, you know, when you read it kind of didn't do much for you, and I wonder if when you watched it you kind of had that, you know, that sort of thought a little bit in your head kind of going into it, do you know what I mean?
I don't know, actually. Possibly. I think, actually, when I got around to watching it, I was thinking, well, I didn't enjoy the book, but let's see what the TV series is like. I think a lot of it actually, and it's probably true with a few stories that are kind of hailed as legendary, is that there's a lot of hype for it to live up to. So this is a story, it's one of the earliest Tom Baker stories, right? It was kind of, you know, it started, the genesis of this story began really with Robert Holmes and Barry Letts, even just before Philip Hinchcliffe was fully installed as producer. He was on his way, but he hadn't quite taken over yet. So, you know, Robert Holmes was busy grabbing stories and Barry Letts was kind of working with him, you know, so just trying to get all this stuff together before it kind of run in. So I was watching this at least 10 years after it had been aired, and you know, there had been, even in that short time between the mid 70s and mid 80s, you know, a certain shift in the way that stories have been told. And you know, and you can see when you look at Doctor Who in the 80s, you can see it desperately trying to kind of pull away from that, because the style of telling stories on TV had changed. Things had become a little bit snappier, a little bit quicker, a little bit more visual. And, you know, you look at stories like Earthshock, for example, which are influenced by things like the Alien movies, you know, and the stuff James Cameron was doing. That's kind of what Eric Saward really wanted to get on TV with Doctor Who. You've got Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, all of those sort of things, and all those cheapo fantasy and sci-fi films that sort of came after it, and all the really good sci-fi films. You had Star Trek going through a resurgence with the Star Trek movies, and then you got Doctor Who, right, which was trying to pull into those things.
So like maybe Warriors of the Deep is sort of like Die Hard, really.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. You said it. Exactly. Legendary.
But it's
influenced
thinking,
by all of that stuff.
Sorry, I just say, if you're thinking, shut up, Jeff, that was how I referred to it as when we reviewed Warriors of the Deep
Warriors
a while ago.
Of the Deep.
Because it was, you know, much like, you know, Die Hard, you could say, is the ultimate sort of base under siege, albeit, you know, a high rise in LA, but, you know, it's still a base. It's still under siege.
When I used to look at some of these, this night, you know, Doctor Who from the 70s, I was quite often quite underwhelmed with a lot of it, because it just didn't feel as snappy. Mm. It felt a lot more basic to me, and you know, and even the ones where I'd really enjoyed the Target novels, I wasn't always that impressed by them, you know. And don't forget, you know, I'm sort of a stroppy teenager at this point anyway, so, you know, a lot of these things are kind of, it's a bit shit, that, you know, I didn't really enjoy it. It's not as good as I thought it was going to be. So it wasn't until I became a much more emotionally mature sort of person in my sort of later years that I really appreciated these things for what they actually are. And I do think, you know, now, and maybe that's it, actually, you know, because I'm a little bit older, I can maybe appreciate Pyramids of Mars in a slightly more enthusiastic way than I ever used to. But it's taken a long time, to get to that point.
Well, it's funny because, so sometimes when you watch something, it may not immediately gel for you, or you know, you listen to a song or an album, and you know, it can, you know, they can take a while sometimes, can't they? You know, I always kind of like to give an album a couple of tries, you know, even if it doesn't sort of immediately click with me, unless, you know, like, it just, like, I know it's not going to work at all for me. You know, and I wouldn't necessarily watch a film, you know, four times in a row if I wasn't unsure about it. But, you know, as you grow older, and I think, you know, your tastes change slightly, and
they do,
you know, something that you weren't too keen on, you know, a long time ago, now you see it in a different light, and you know, positively or negatively. And I think that you know, like you were saying, it's quite slow, this one, and I think, you know, sometimes people find Classic Who a little bit difficult to watch in some ways, don't they, because it is so different to what we're used to.
It's
with the show
really
now,
yeah, you know, especially from this era,
yeah. And which is really, you know, rattles along, and you know, that's just what TV was like back then, and the same with films. Funny enough, today I watched Wizard of Oz with my kids again, and the girls they found a CG animated series on Netflix, sort of, can't remember what it's called. It's a Wizard of Oz sort of thing. And they said, "Oh, can we watch the Wonderful Wizard film?" And and I said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, we'll watch it later." And Ella said, "Oh, this bit at the beginning is boring till it comes in colour."
I love the bit at the beginning.
Yeah, and we were watching it, and I was thinking, how did they do that shot where she walks out of the black and white house, sepia, into Oz world? And I think that the set was painted.
You know how they did it, right?
Well, my thinking, and you tell me, but there's a girl in a sepia costume, and the set's painted, and as the door opens, then actual Judy Garland walks in to go
exactly
through.
That. Yeah.
And then when the Wicked Witch appears, Phoebe said, "How have they done that?" And so we paused it, went by frame by frame. I said, "You can see the flap lift up, the red smoke comes out. She's clearly on a elevator." And then if you watch closely, there's a panel that swings back round to cover the hole in the floor. And,
so you basically took the magic away from
it. I took it away, but I thought it was brilliant that she wanted to see how it was done. But my original point here was that it's a film that is, what, 80 years old or something?
Something or other, isn't it?
Yeah, 39, I think it was. And, we watched the whole thing. And it's not the first time they've seen it, but, you know, it's quite different to modern stuff. It's still quite pacey, but there's a lot of long shots, by which I mean there's no cuts in them, and it's still that sort of theatrical style of filming theatre, if you look at the old Hammer films like Dracula and stuff. It's much like early Who, it's essentially theatre that's been filmed. There's no multiple takes on it particularly.
That's the thing that I always struggle with, not just watching Doctor Who, but a lot of stuff from there. I mean, saying that, a lot of it depends on the strength of the story. So, I mean, something like I, Claudius, for example, right, which is filmed around about the same sort of time as this, I think, is literally the definition of theatre shot with TV cameras. It's very static by today's standards, and could be quite difficult. But I watched it again, actually, probably around about the same time as I watched this, because I watched that mid 80s, and I just couldn't get enough of it, because the story in I, Claudius is so very, very strong. It just, if you're into that kind of thing, it just pulls you in. And I was watching every episode like religiously, and I've watched it loads of times since on DVD. I bought the book of it and everything, and I just absolutely couldn't get enough of it. And that is exactly what you're saying. That is, as I said, theatre on TV, but it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
With some of these Doctor Who stories, actually, it does matter, because either the story isn't quite strong enough. It might be on the surface, and I think this is one of those where the surface detail is enough to pull people in generally, because it is really strong. It's the imagery is really strong. The mummies, Sutek, all the Egyptian stuff. It's so lovingly done. It's so brilliantly done, right? And it's so convincingly done, even in a way by today's standards. Those sets and props, they look fantastic. Mm. They look great. For me, the story isn't very strong. I think it's strong in part one, and I think part two and three, it's okay. It kind of chugs along and does what it's supposed to do. But then I think by part four, it's just gone straight into kind of just formulaic stuff, really. I think one of the things that this era of Doctor Who really suffers from is the kind of bad guy showdown thing. If you look at a lot of these stories, Hand of Fear is another one, right? Which again, it follows the same pattern. Really strong part one,
and
then kind of slides. But yeah. I think part four, apart from the very end of part four of Hand of Fear, it's just a shouting match. You've just got a pantomime villain, but you've got a villain who is just literally spouting stuff from the back of a Weetabix packet, it seems to me. You shall not curse me, Doctor. Now you will pay with your life, or something like that. It's usually those sort of words, I just don't buy it. I'll watch it. Whatever, I won't. It's just not the thing that floats my boat.
No, and I wonder what you would have thought if you'd watched it going out live when you were, 10 or something.
I would have been, maybe. Well, I don't know. Differently, perhaps. I mean, mid-80s.
But
it's a different age, though, isn't it, right? I probably would have thought, because, you know, by the time I was that sort of age, right, Star Wars had happened, and Flash Gordon, and all of that kind of stuff, and, you know, sci-fi in particular just been ramped up massively, so people's expectations of you know, the kind of speed at which these stories were being told, and the special effects, and, you know, all that kind of stuff was really, really high going into the 80s. And it seemed like even the cheaper films, I'm talking things like Hawk the Slayer, right? It's brilliant, by the way. It's so cheesy. It's unreal. But, you know, and we had things like Knight Rider coming in from the US. We had Buck Rogers in the 25th century. Battlestar Galactica, which is even a little bit older, but still had those kind of, you know, zappy lasers and effects and things. Actually, Battlestar Galactica is actually, you know, that's a lot of that series is actually pretty pants. It's so formulaic. But the first three stories in that series, which formed the movie, which I went to see, you know, as many times as I could, which is brilliant, you know. And then along comes kind of lumbering Doctor Who, and you can see it in the 80s with things like, as I said, like Earthshock, where Eric Sayward is trying to push things away, and Peter Grimwade as well. They're trying to do it. They're trying to move stuff on a little bit, tell stories a bit quicker. I mean, Earthshock is one of those stories which I think at the time had the most cuts in it, you know, like shortest scenes, the highest number of scenes, and the greatest number of camera angles from a static studio floor setup. You know, Peter Grimwade, who directed, was really trying to push the boat out. And interestingly, Peter Grimwade, because I'm cycling it back to Pyramids of Mars, was a production assistant on Pyramids of Mars. Now, don't get me wrong, right, because I what I'm saying, I know it sounds slightly negative, right, I'm going to come back to a point which I just made about the part four shouty villain syndrome, right, because I think what's different about Pyramids of Mars is simply Gabriel Wolfe, who plays and voices Sutek, really, right? Because the dialogue he's given at the end, you know, in that story, especially in part four, is very standard. It's kind of like the demons, right? And this story reminds me a lot of the demons, actually, for similar reasons, right? And, you know, at the end of the demons and the end of Hand of Fear, we've got Stephen Thorne, actually, in both stories, doing the shouty villain. And it varies like a pantomime stage villain shouting very melodramatically, very over the top, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff, and I just don't like that. But with Gabriel Wolfe, he brings it in. He's got that beautiful melodic, silky, deep voice that you just, it's unmistakable, and you can't get it anywhere else. And I do remember the first time I watched the VHS of this, I was so taken in by that voice alone. I thought it was fantastic, and I just wanted to hear more of it. You know, it's brilliant. And of course, they brought him back for The Impossible Planet, The Satan Pit. When was that? 2006 or whatever it is. You know, to voice the Beast back then.
And that voice with is David brilliant. Tennant.
It's brilliant. So Gabriel Wolfe delivers that sort of dialogue, that type of dialogue, but he doesn't get all shouty and blah 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 blah. He brings it down, and it seems to work a lot better at the end of Pyramids of Mars than it does, you know, when you've got Magnus Greil shouting off at the end of Talons, or, like I said, you know, Azal at the end of the Demons, or you know, the Castrian, whatever his name is, Eldrad, you know, the male Eldrad.
I wonder if the end of Fear. You know, I wonder if the shouty villain thing is, you know, partly because the show is kind of aimed at kids as well. I think that's just
how it was done. It was just that style of fantasy slash sci-fi. Well,
It keeps it simple. It's like sometimes when I'm watching stuff with my kids, and, you know, they're very young, and I'm watching a, you know, cartoon with them, and I think, that doesn't make sense. All you need to do is go and do that, and it's solved. Yeah. But there's no story without, you know, if they do that. But also, they don't pick up on something like that because they're not, you know, looking for things like that or sort of experienced enough in watching things to kind of read them that way and stuff. So
no, so you just want the story to be told, don't you?
Yeah. So I'm just sort of thinking, you know, the bad guy, you know, being shouty. You know, I suppose I'm sort of, you know, defending it in some ways, you know, is you know, maybe because of that. But it's a bit that makes me think for some reason of Dar-Ben, who was in the Marvels recently, and you know, she wasn't the most complex of the recent villains, you know, in the MCU. If you look at you know, the Mandarin or you know, Hela, so on that sort of thing, she was just sort of, you know, average, you know, comic book film villain, but she looked cool, with the teeth, and she had some fearsome looking facial expressions, and you know, she was clearly having a ball doing it. So for me, even though, you know, technically there's better villains, I had a lot of fun with the performance and the character, and sometimes, you know, that's enough, I think, certainly for me anyway, you know, being a simpleton. But you know, so Sutek, you know, it may not be as you know, rich as some others, you know. But also, it was interesting that you said, you know, this sort of you know, style of the show is not your your sort of ultimate favourite. And again, it brings back the thing that Chris Chibnall said about the show being kind of, you know, volumes of the same.
Yeah, exactly. You know, thing. Yeah.
And
it constantly moves and it evolves. You know, season 13, where this story came from, I mean, it contains so many classics. You know, Brain of Morbius, Android Invasion, Planet of Evil, Seas of Doom, you know, and this one. I don't know, did I forget another one? I can't remember now. But Terror of the Zygons as well, which was supposed to close off the previous season. And they're all, you know, they are really good. There's no doubt about it. I generally enjoy watching all of those stories, and there's kind of flaws, quotation fingers, if you like, with all of them. But you know, each one of these stories had a story behind the scenes, you know, which kind of led it. And nonetheless, what they achieved has left such an impression on the minds of the people who saw this at the time that, regardless of whatever flaws and whatever my opinions on a particular story may be, you know, you can't take any of that away, and I wouldn't ever want to. These stories are not of my era, you know, they're not of my generation. I came to it, as I said before, with stories like Warrior's Gate, which couldn't be any more different, than Pyramids of Mars. You know, it's a much more high concept type of thing. It doesn't have mummies or anything like that, and arguably makes even less sense on TV than Pyramids of Mars does, you know. But nonetheless, it's just different imaginations being fired by different triggers, really. That's what it is. You know, mine was fired by the Great White Void and the Gothic Arch, and the idea of, you know, in Logopolis of entropy, and in Warrior's Gate of kind of slipping between universes and stuff like that, and you know, the idea of some kind of underlying sort of quantum thing that allowed you to kind of model the universe in a certain, you know, I loved all those sort of ideas. Just, it's complete nonsense as having, you know, a radio beacon from Mars holding an ancient Egyptian god imprisoned in Egypt for 7,000 years. You know, it's just bonkers. It doesn't matter. We all come from different things.
That's the thing, you know, it just because, you know, this didn't work for you as well as it worked for me, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean it's bad. And I think, you know, that's something to, you know, always bear in mind with a show that changes so much, is that, you know, an episode may not work for you as well as another one, but it doesn't mean it's bad, you know, like
exactly.
this episode, you know, this story, reminds me a little bit, you know, in sort of theme anyway, of like Hyde or, you know, Villa Diodata, you know, that sort of gothic horror type thing, you know, Spooky Mansion and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, I love those kind of stories.
Yeah, I like those stories. I think actually, I mean, Hyde was interesting, and to agree, I think. I mean, I really liked Villa Diodata. I thought that was... I mean, again, yeah, you're right. It was, in many ways, it's as derivative as Pyramids of Mars and a lot of those stories are, you know. But it puts the chills right into it. I think, you know, I think Pyramids of Mars in part one, the chills are there, right? Because you've got some great stuff going on. And again, imagine this in the modern series, right? You've got that opening shot of the pyramids in Egypt, and you've got an archaeological dig going on. It didn't have captions, and then I don't think, does it say 1911? I can't remember if it does or not.
I'm not sure.
Actually,
I can't remember.
But anyway, you know, we cut to the inside of the pyramid, and we got Marcus Scarman digging through, you know, and imagine that now as it would be filmed, you know, it'd have smoky light, you know, they'd set up the lighting, so, and it'd be all kind of Rays of the Last Ark-esque, and, you know, be really evoking that sort of thing, which actually this does before Rays of the Last Ark, you know, it's tapping into, you know, very popular Egyptology type stuff, and like you said, you know, the Universal Mummy movies and the Hammer House horror stuff that was popular as well. And you know, and again, I don't mind. See, I again, this is why I said, you know, right at the start, I have a love-hate relationship.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because there's so much about it I really shouldn't like, and there are things that I do dislike, but in the end, I do actually kind of like these stories.
Yeah, that's good.
They somehow fight through all the things that are stopping me mentally from just accepting it as it is, you know. And actually, at the end, it's still really enjoyable. So, I mean, for example, right, you know, I'm not a big fan of stories that are so obviously derivative as this, usually. Right, it's totally ripping off. It's not ripping off the storyline, but it's pulling all the tropes, right, from the Mummy and, you know, the Universal and the Hammer stuff. You know, it's just there, and it's unashamedly, gloriously enjoying it doing that. You know, which again is fine. But what I do kind of like, so I sort of dislike the idea of that because I don't like these things where they do that shamelessly. But on the other hand, they do it and then match it with sci-fi type stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because at the heart of this golden era of Doctor Who, right, you've got two forces. You've got Robert Holmes on one hand, and you've got Philip Hinchcliffe on the other hand. Now, Robert Holmes was very much into horror, right? Mm. And he really wanted to do things as scary as possible. Yeah. He really wanted to have children, right? Just running away, screaming in terror from the big ugly monsters and everything else. He wanted to frighten the buggers. I think that's, you know, it's literally what he says, frighten the little buggers with his pipe, puff, 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 right? Whereas Philip Hinchcliffe wanted to sort of move away from the, you know, everything which are kind of I'd been identified in the John Pertwee years, so a lot of Earthbound stories, a lot of Earthbound topics, a lot of contemporary themes, and just wanted unashamed science fiction. You know, he wanted to have adventures in space, he wanted spaceships and just stuff like that, higher concept stuff. So you've got this kind of push and pull almost between the horror of Robert Holmes on the one hand and the serious sci-fi of Philip Hinchcliffe on the other. And when those two things, you know, when those two guys got together and started putting their ideas together, we got some great stories.
Yeah,
everything in this story, right, which may began, I mean, certainly Pyramids began with conversations between Barry Letts and Robert Holmes because Philip Hinchcliffe wasn't quite on board yet. But everything which happened during the season as it developed, and then in the season afterwards, which saw things like Images of the Fendal and Robots of Death and, you know, have I lost it? No, Mask of Mandraga, wasn't it? And The Deadly Assassin.
Yeah.
And Hand of Fear. Hand of Fear, Deadly Assassin, Robot... No. Face of Evil. I'm struggling now. Face of Evil, Robots of Death, and then The Talons of Wayne Trying. I got there in the end. You know, I'm getting old now, not as good as I used to be. But, you know, all those stories, again, that is, again, as a result of this, you know, Hinchcliffe and Holmes just getting together and just figuring all this stuff out. You look at Robots of Death in the next series, right, which is an unashamed rip-off of two sources again, right? You've got, it's a rip-off of Dune, right, which is very part of the Frank Herbert novel, now, you know, part two of the film coming out of Denis Villeneuve, and Isaac Asimov's kind of robot series, and also actually a third influence, which is Agatha Christie's kind of murder mystery type things. And yet it tells, you know, an original story. To my mind, better than Pyramids of Mars does, but Pyramids of Mars was written in very different circumstances, right? So originally, just a little diversion of this. So Robert Holmes, when he was made script editor at the start of Tom, you know, at the end of sort of John Pertwee and into Tom Baker series, he was, you know, he's out finding stories and looking for writers. And he went back to his buddies at ATV, where he used to work, and he pulled in people like Lewis Marks, who had previously written Day of the Daleks, and who wrote Planet of Evil and another one, which escapes me, Mask of Mandragora, for you know, Robert Holmes. He pulled in Robert Banks Stewart, who wrote Seas of Doom and also Terror of the Zygons. And he pulled in this guy, Lewis Griefer, who'd written episodes of The Prisoner and Danger Man, and he'd been a story editor on loads of other stuff as well, right? Now, Lewis Marks had already written for Doctor Who. Robert Banks Stewart got on with it and wrote Terror of the Zygons first. That was his great thing, right? And it was brilliant. It just all fitted. It all worked. But Lewis Griefer, apparently, right, was coming out with some really complex ideas. So Robert Holmes had said to him, you know, Barry Letts, it's like, you know, we want an Egypt-type story. We want the mummy, right? We want all the candy, basically. We give us mummies, give us this, give us that, all that kind of stuff. And apparently Lewis Griefer was quite into Egyptology. He sort of loved all that kind of stuff. So he wrote this story, and it was apparently very complex. It involved, you know, sort of sending grain to the moon and a bit of duplicitousness on politicians. Horus was a politician and blah, 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 blah. I think it was going to be a unit story at one point as well. And, you know, Robert Holmes sort of tried to work with him on it and said, well, okay, maybe that's not working. Try this. And they had some big convoluted idea of also, you know, featuring rockets to Mars and the moon and, you know, the Brigadier being taken over by Sutek and all kinds of stuff like that. And it just kind of went on and on and on. And eventually, you know, production date is getting close. They'd agreed that Lewis was going to write the scripts. They'd sort of signed off the storyline, but they're still sort of changing it as they go. And then Lewis Grieffer got a job in Israel as a lecturer or tutor or something, went to work on that. He'd already written some of the scripts. He'd done some of the rewrites, and he'd done like three scripts at that point. Couldn't finish it off, and in the end it was like, well, it's still not really working. It's still not, you know, Philip Hinchcliffe allegedly kind of looked at it when it was at quite an advanced stage and said it just isn't going to work. It's too complex. It involved the British Museum as well, so we're never going to be able to film at the British Museum. They're never going to allow us to do that. You know, so it had to come down to, well, to Rob Holmes, and he says, well, you're going to have to rewrite it, basically. You know, just take whatever's there and do the thing. And here's the thing, right? So Robert Holmes at this point he'd been working on a rewrite of he'd just finished rewriting Revenge of the Cybermen, right? Because here's the thing, right? So season 12 finished in 1975, around about sort of April, May, I think, and then season 13 followed it in not very end of August, start of September. Right, so it was only like a few weeks that between seasons that Doctor Who was off the air. So for behind the scenes, that's a continuous period. Yeah. So like I said, so Robert Holmes is rewriting Jerry Davis's Revenge of the Cybermen pretty much from scratch. He's already rewritten The Ark in Space, but which was originally by John Lucarotti, again pretty much from scratch, taking the sort of initial ideas and doing something with them. And he's doing this really quickly. And now suddenly he's got to rewrite Pyramids of Mars from scratch. And he doesn't have a lot of time to do it, right? Is the production line is, you know, the rehearsal dates are pretty much booked. The cast is all getting signed up. The Paddy Russell, a director, she's kind of on board pretty much. It was her first Doctor Who. And then, and here's another thing. So when she gets on board, right, there's only a first draft of the script available. And she looks at it and she's like, apparently, you know, this is pretty weak. You know, this doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. Why are they doing this? Why is this occurring here? What about that? And she was apparently quite into Egyptology as well. So she and Robert Holmes sat down and kind of just worked on other bits of the script. So you've got, you know, a script which has been through a whole load of process before it's even got to the rehearsal room, really. And then, you know, so for the likes of me to say, well, you know, it doesn't make sense that the radio signal beam from Mars is completely wanky. Frankly, and I know, and well, I'm unashamedly sorry about that, guys, but you know, it is what it is, you know. But so I think, you know, the fact that they crafted something which left such an indelible mark in so many people across the globe, because people will always remember the one with the giant maggots or the one with the mummies or Are You My Mummy or, you know, whatever, according to the stories that made an impact on them at the time, at the right time. And this is definitely one of those, and those who love it will unashamedly love it, and they're quite right to do so. But it's interesting that those of us who sort of came later, or a few of us anyway, you know, a few tossers like me, who sort of looking and going, well, you know, it doesn't quite work there, and it's not quite as good as I thought it was going to be, but nonetheless, that's my feeling towards it, you know?
Well, no, that's fine. This ended up being put out under a pseudonym for the writing credit, didn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. Stephen Harris. So Lewis Grieffer had kind of agreed that, you know, he didn't really want his name to be used. You know, they gave him the option. They said, look, you know, we can put your name on it. It's up to you. If you don't want to be associated with it, it's fine. We'll think of the pseudonym. And I think Philip Hinchcliffe had to apply to get the BBC to sign off that Robert Holmes should write two stories this season, you know, so or something like that, or two stories per season. They said, okay, you can do this one, and they had to check with the Writers Guild and all that kind of stuff, was, you know, and there's the thing, right? When you think now about the fact we've got a showrunner who is essentially the script writer, you know, and they, you know, their kind of expectation is that they will pretty much write all the scripts for that season. They will framework the story arc, the narrative arc. They'll compose the characters and, you know, the sort of high points of where they're going to change and what's going to happen and all of that sort of stuff. Whereas back in 1975 and you know, in the 80s, like that was just not allowed.
No.
You know, you can't have a script editor write scripts. God, no. That's taken away the job of an actual writer, you know. And I see that. I get it. But there's a sign of how things have changed. And I think even in the 80s, that was starting to change. There was a lot of stress and push and pull throughout the 80s and 90s in the way TV was being made. You know, if you think in the 90s was the era of independent broadcasting, when things were outsourced, you know, program making was outsourced to independent production companies and things. And, you know, the Americans had already had writers' rooms and stuff like that. And they were starting to kind of dictate almost how it was going to be, how TV was going to show. But yeah, back in the 70s and the 80s, you had a script editor and a producer literally getting their heads together, doing their damnedest to try and get these stories put together and made and sent out and everything else. And you would think in a lot of ways, the script editor is the best person to kind of write them. They're in charge of the scripts. When you look at the Pertwee era, I mean, Terrence Dicks rewrote so many of those behind the scenes. You know, he's literally taking, you know, he's contracting people in, but he's working on the scripts himself, and some of them are almost total rewrites.
Yeah,
the Three Doctors, really, it's credited to Bob Baker and Dave Martin, but it should also, Terrence Dicks had a massive hand in that.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it is because situations are forcing him that weren't foreseen. You know, William Hartnell's illness and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm pretty sure in Pyramids of Mars, Robert Holmes never had any intention. He'd had his hands full anyway. He's got to finish the rewrites on Cybermen and everything else. And he's also got to try and find the rest of the stories for this season and start looking at next season as well. He doesn't have time to sit down, spend a week writing a bloody script about Egyptian robot mummies and stuff like that. But he's got to do it.
He's got to be done,
and it's incredible. And you can see there are certain points where, you know, he kind of throws everything at it. And, you know, and just sort of coming away from that. So I've got a few points on here which, you know, I wanted to discuss with you.
I was just going to say, I one thing I liked in here is that where they go forward in time and see that...
That was one of them, yes.
Wrecked. Mm. And... you know, that sort of playing with time there, you know, because if I remember rightly, they say, well, maybe we could just go and leave him to do it. And, you know, we know the world doesn't end in...
Yeah,
you know,
Sarah Jane says it, doesn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
She's and then, like, we know Sutekh didn't actually destroy the world in 1911. So we're fine, we can just go. And then the Doctor shows what happens if they don't act.
Yeah. So that's quite like that.
There was a shot, apparently, or I don't know if it was filmed or whether it was suggested, it was just written and they didn't film it, but there's a shot of the TARDIS kind of landed in this blasted landscape of the future 1980, you know, post-Sutekh. But Paddy Russell in the end decided it was better if they just showed the TARDIS door opening and then Sarah Jane's and Lawrence Scarman's face in reaction to the horror of what they were seeing.
Well, it's you know, what you don't see is worse in your head, you know.
It's the character reactions, isn't it?
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
When you do imagining. See like the faces, it's pretty horrifying. And I'd say something else I like about this story as well, actually, is again another similarity it has with the demons, is that the Doctor's in a very somber, almost pissed off mood throughout the whole of it.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, definitely in the demons, he's completely stroppy throughout the whole thing, right? Because he's just not having it. And and it's similar in this one, right? The first
Sarah
time
Jane says something about it, doesn't
she? Yeah, she tries to cheer him up, right? But there's this great shot of Tom Baker standing there, and it's the first shot of Tom in that story. He's standing in the TARDIS with his hat sort of down over his eyes, scarf. You know, he's the silhouette of the Doctor, and he's standing there, right? And Sarah Jane comes flouncing in with this new dress that she found,
and he's like, Victoria,
and, you know, and it's just. And he's like, I walk in eternity. You don't understand what that means. You know, the responsibility placed upon me, blah, 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 all that. And Sarah's like, oh, you know, Philip must be middle-aged or something like that. You know, and she's trying to cheer him up. I know the dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, they're great.
All of this season. This is Pete, Tom, and Liz. You know, they're brilliant throughout. You know, and this, I think it's the chemistry between them that actually somehow makes these stories come to life, you know, for whatever I or other people might think is wrong with them. You know, the love and the dynamic at the heart of their relationship is so strong.
Yeah.
You know, it's and it feels so real as well. You know, I just love it. I think it's great.
Yeah,
but you do get Tom. It's the Doctor, really, because I think Tom was okay with Paddy Russell in this story. He wasn't always, and I think in the Horror of Fang Rocky, he and her had a real sort of conflicts, you know, bad relationship. But I think in this one it was more or less okay. But you do get the Doctor behaving alien, right? Not human. He's constantly reminding us that he's not human when Sarah Jane expects him to behave a little bit more compassionately. Mm-hmm. So when Lawrence Scarman is kind of done for in part three, I think it is, and he just, the doctor walks in, he just sort of throws the body to one side to make room for himself or something, you know, and Sarah Jane, she's horrified at the way he's done that. You know what I mean? And he's, because this is their friend, you know, this is someone who became their friend throughout this story. And the doctor's just, you know, well, we've got bigger things on. We've literally got to stop this, you know, this dude from taking, from destroying the universe. Because that's what he will do, you know. Yeah. And regardless of this, this doesn't matter. So, but she's like, no, the little things do matter, you know, because, you know, this is a man who had his life, right? He had a family and, you know, and now he's dead because of this.
He needed some Clara cue cards to help him there.
It's always been part of the Doctor's makeup.
Well, it has been, yeah, exactly,
You know, I think the Doctor's always aspired to be morally righteous.
Yeah, but it's perhaps not...
or at least not in human terms.
Yeah, it's not the innate thing, and it's, you know, a goal to be like that, perhaps, and it doesn't necessarily always, you know, come easy. Now, before you brought up your couple of things to discuss, I had a factoid that I don't think many people know, that this part of this episode was filmed at Mick Jagger's house.
Stargroves.
Stargroves, yeah. And did you know that when they first went there to film, Tom Baker wasn't very happy with the location and he couldn't get satisfied by it. He could get no satisfaction. And... he also had an issue with one of the doors was bright red, and he really didn't like it, and he wanted to get it painted black.
And I mean,
I'm not stopping.
I don't know what to say there, mate.
And he went into the kitchen. He wanted to make a cup of tea, and he was very disappointed to find out that they didn't have any white sugar. They just had brown sugar. And he said, "Oh well, you can't always get what you want."
Dear, yeah. How long did it take to make those, mate?
Well, I've been thinking about it most of the day, to be honest.
yeah. It was indeed filmed at Stargroves, which apparently Mick Jagger's parents were living there at the time.
Yeah, really?
I believe. Yeah. And I think there were a few locations which Peter Grimwade had sort of sorted out, but this was the only one which not only had the house of the right sort they were looking for, but had all the woods around it as well, which they really wanted. You know, they could have travelled to the woods, but actually it's better, isn't it, if it's all on one location. And they used this location again the following year for, what was it, the year after, for Image of the Fendal.
Right.
So... it was a year after. It was the Graham Williams first season.
Just reading up, 1840, it was destroyed 15. In a fire. New one was built.
Mm.
And then Jagger bought it. £55,000. Blimey.
Imagine that.
Unbelievable.
That's all. Yeah,
they did a number of albums there.
Yeah. And he donated his feet, apparently, to a school for visually impaired children in Wimbledon. So... yeah, there you go. There's a factoid for you.
Factoid for you there.
Are you satisfied now?
I am, yeah.
It's difficult a thing to get these days. So, so we got a brilliant cast in this one as well. Yeah. So, what do you recall of the cast of this?
Well, the guy Sutek's voice, his performance, like you were saying earlier, he's brilliant. And actually, I wanted to say earlier that he seems like a really popular villain, and it, someone I think commented online, maybe on Facebook, that they were surprised he was never brought back in the show.
Yeah,
and I know there's a few audios, and the Tenth Doctor had a. I think it was a Titan series, where Sutek was back, but it was sort of, it was a weird one because he was sort of reborn as a child, and he was kind of more dog-faced looking, and there was a bit of the sort of moral quandary of, is he going to grow up
the infinite corridor, that was it,
is he going to grow up to be like Sutek, or you know, a bit like with what's her name from Boomtown, you know, with the Slitheen.
know, egg, yeah.
You know,
Margaret.
That sort of thing. Margaret, that's it, yeah. Blathy, yeah. You know, will he grow up to be the same or not? And he was a companion for a bit in that series, and then he, Sutek came back somehow. It started to get very complicated. Hence why I can't really remember it all clearly. But it was quite good, yeah. But yeah, it is quite a strong villain, and you know, there's always a way to bring something back, you know, whether they die or not, you know.
Yeah, and there was a Justin Richards novel, Virgin Mist and Adventure, called The Sands of Time, which I think I haven't read it, to be honest, so I couldn't really sort of say much about it, but I know that featured. I think it featured the Sirens and maybe Horus and Sutek in some way. Yeah. I don't know, but it was one of those I was always meant to get round to reading, and I might actually have it on there, thinking about it, on my shelf somewhere. It's a good point, actually. You kind of think that Sutek would be an ideal villain to return, but actually, when you think about it, there aren't many Fourth Doctor villains or monsters that put in a second appearance.
Look at the Zygons. It took them a long time to come back.
Yeah. But just one of the things that typifies Tom Baker's era is that pretty much all the villains, with the exception of the Daleks, who are in twice, and the Master, who's in the three times, I suppose, right? Pretty much every story is a unique villain, think. Correct me if I'm wrong in that. The Suntarans, okay, we'd had them previously. But they didn't occur. They did occur again with Invasion of Time. So there's another one that was repeated, actually. Mm. But apart from the Suntarans, the Master, and the Daleks, they're all unique.
Yeah, that's true. I was just looking.
I believe.
There's only a handful of stuff with Sutek in, actually, from Big Finish. I thought they'd done more for some reason, but
I think Gabriel Wolfe has. Narrated stuff. A few audiobooks and things, hasn't he? BBC books.
BBC books, yeah.
He's got a great voice. He's got a brilliant voice, you know, which is.
Yeah,
he's
in a few, actually. As the other characters, yeah.
And saying about the, about Sutek and all the rest of it, I have to say, and this is another great thing of Robert Holmes, because his world building is fabulous. You know, there's one thing I did like. From my early experiences of watching and reading this story, is that whole backstory about the Assyrians and Horus and Sutek and, you know, the world they come from. You know, it's so far in the past, and yet it was so far advanced. You know, it's this, and again, it fits in brilliantly with, you know, the idea of, like you were saying, Egyptians as, you know, the Egyptian gods as space aliens and stuff like that, because it's just completely. And I think, was it Chariots of the Gods? That was a book that was around at the time. There was a whole bunch of documentaries anyway, which have sort of gone over the years, and it all about sort of those ancient civilizations has been influenced by people from beyond realm, like that. So that, I think that was quite a hot topic at the time. So it's really great that this kind of ties into that idea and gives it some agency, if you like. You know, it kind of fuels the story because it provides the reason for Sutek to be imprisoned. It gives us an idea of the danger that he represents. And actually, it's one thing in the book that I really love, because the book goes into it in a little bit more detail. It's like the first opening epilogue is a page and a half or so, just describing how Sutek came to be imprisoned and what sort of, you know, obviously what led up to those events. And it's great. And that's the sort of thing that my imagination probably got fired more about than robot mummies squishing a poacher in the woods, although visually that is quite nasty. So another thing about this story, there are some nasty deaths in it. Everybody dies. Apart from the Doctor and Sarah Jane, nobody survives outside of this at the end. They're all squished.
Yeah, I think someone blown up. It was quite violent.
It's quite violent. Yeah.
I'll go to a few comments if that's all right.
Why not? Yeah.
So Chris Botger, music.
Are these from Twitter?
Yes. Yeah, I'll let you do Facebook, actually.
Okay.
If that's right.
Yeah.
So Chris is a new face. Hello, Chris. Great episode. Probably my favourite from season 13. Sutek is a great one-off villain, and the mummies are very cool. Mm. The rock and roll guy says, my favourite, the best doctor, the best companion, the best enemy, the best production team, Doctor Who at its absolute peak. Our pal Fraser Gregory says this is officially the 48th greatest story of all time. For reasons what he wrote, and I have retweeted.
I've seen
this
those reasons; they're very good.
Blog post
I enjoyed his blog, actually.
Yes,
definitely
really
highly
good,
recommended.
Yeah. Daniel Knight says, I think it's a great story, very atmospheric, with everyone giving fine performances, not one duff actor in this at all. Sutek is a chilling adversary, and yet despite all the doom and gloom, it does have my absolute favourite funny moment ever, and that's the Doctor and Sarah Jane walking into the room as the mummy
the
turns
Marx
and they leave.
Thing that they
yeah, and someone else shared that gif with Nope flashing up on it.
Yeah,
just seen it. But, so there's loads here. I'll just read a handful. John Bensalia says, an all-time classic and my second favourite story of all time. John, if you're listening, I'd like to know what your first favourite story is. Dramatic, scary, funny, cracking cast, moody direction, Tom and Liz at their very best. Lucy McCall says, I like it a lot. It captures the atmosphere of a historical horror movie and gives it a science fiction twist, which is what you were saying there about the two guys. The mummies are threatening. Hashtag mummy tits. And that's...
what? I beg your pardon?
Well, this will explain it. At Doc Oho, at Felix Fraser. So I suspect it's something to do with those naughty boys. and Gabriel Wolf is magnificent in a mostly vocal performance. What a voice.
He's hidden by a mask throughout the whole thing. And you know, the story requires that he's paralysed. He can't move. It's all got to be on the voice. And he has such a good voice. Without even, someone on Facebook pointed out, without even lifting a finger, you know?
Yeah, imagine if he didn't have the voice to make that part.
Exactly. Well, if it was someone like Stephen Thorne, for all his presence, you know, Stephen Thorne is all just one note. It's just shouty villain. You know, this story needs more than that. And I think what Gabriel Wolf brings to it is just, it's just unique and just beautiful.
Lucy did a little mini thread here. She says, the idea of aliens as ancient gods was current at the time, with Chariots of the Gods being published.
It was Chariots of the Gods, yes. It was about them.
And it's an idea that still hangs around today on peculiar documentaries. The Doctor and Sarah have brilliant chemistry, and the support and cast is very good. You care about everyone. And then Peter Byrom, who is a new commenter. Too violent. I thought so since I first watched it as a 9-year-old. So, like you said, everyone getting squished and stuff. a Jill sandwich for any Resident Evil fans out there. Mestor the Magnificent. I won't offer an opinion because I don't think I'll add anything new. I will simply share that, A, I have fond memories of its 1994 repeat on Sunday mornings on Beep 2, and I've met Sutek himself. Lovely man. That's fantastic.
Good man.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So there's a handful of comments here from PlayStation Gamer 187, Eduardo M. Freya the First, Martin T. Piero, Kieran Johnson, basically all it's fantastic. Chris Smith, Stone Cold Classic, Rich Powell, a true great. And then Railway Sparrow here says, I honestly wasn't a big fan of it. It's not bad, but it's a run-of-the-mill early Baker story. Just a bit meh for my taste, personally. But Sarah with a gun is a highlight. So that's quite interesting. Not everyone's favourite there.
No, that's the thing. It is a really popular story, and I think it was watched by a record number. Was it? I don't know. Someone will correct me, but I think it's somewhere between 10 and 12 million, something like that.
10 and 12, and then it went up the next episode. And then sort of levelled out on 3 and 4, I think.
Yeah, but this was a period in Doctor Who where it was regularly getting those sort of numbers.
Yes, it was.
And then I think it slid off a bit and then came back with towards like City of Death or something.
Quite unusual,
because ITV was on strike then, but
That's right. Bottomless Stop here. It says, I think in this episode, maybe for the first time, Sarah realises just how not human the Doctor really is when she sees how he reacts to Lawrence Garman's death, which is what you were saying. So, I could really be here quite a while reading these comments out.
I know, we got a lot of feedback on this one, didn't we? I've pulled off a few Facebook ones, but I'm not going to read all of them. I'll just pull off a few that I've sort of done. But I just wanted to say on the cast, actually, because I did ask you about it, didn't I? And then we kind of got sidetracked. But there are some really interesting casting choices in this one. So, you know, I mean, brilliantly, Michael Sheard is back in Doctor Who. So he'd already been in Doctor to a couple of times before this in the Ark and the Mine of Evil, and would go on to reappear a couple of years later in The Invisible Enemy, Castrovalva, and then Remembrance of the Daleks, which was your first, or one of your first Doctor Who stories that you saw, which is great. But interestingly, we've got, I was just doing a little sort of look through as to who was who. So Michael Sheard is regular. And of course, for people of my sort of years as well, he was Mr. Bronson in Grange Hill, the villain of a lifetime.
Yeah, I've heard that
many of us
before.
We're still suffering PTSD from those years, the Zamo years, as we call them. Bernard Archard, he was a big sort of actor at the time, who played his brother Marcus, and that's a great thing, and just about these two, but I'll talk to the others in a minute. So I love Michael Sheard's performances, and in this story he's a really compassionate soul. He's almost like a delicate soul in a way. He's so, I think every time I watch this, a tragedy of his story, I don't want him to get hurt, and yet he does. He gets psychologically, mentally hurt by the pain of having his the doctor just casually telling him that his brother died a long time ago, and that what he sees now is a walking cadaver. It's just awful. And his expression, he's going through his, he's trying to wrap his head around all the space stuff, the fact there are space aliens. He's trying to get to grips, deal with his brother, right, reappearing suddenly and being controlled by Sutek. And then, and then he has to try and be brave enough to kind of fight at the end, because, he gets involved in a bit of a scuffle, later on. And, he's not a strong person. He's not... he's not weak, but he's very fearful, in some ways, and has to overcome that fear. And I just love the way he's playing, and he's so gentle. He's just he's just a lovely character, Lawrence Garman. And Sarah's pain when she sees that he's been killed, she feels it real. And I kind of do as well, because you don't want him to get killed. So so Michael Sheard is brilliant with that, and the other guy as well, Bernard Archer, who plays his brother Marcus, the walking cadaver, right? He does play the zombie pretty well. It's the kind of stiff movements, but they're not, we talked about this story being a little bit kind of theatrical in some ways at the start of this, but this is one area where it could be really OTT, could be really hammed up. And actually, Bernard sells it by doing it quite subtly. The makeup is a thing that sells it. It's his facial expression that sells it. And yes, his movements are a little bit jerky, but they're not overly so. And there's a beautiful moment just before he does his brother in, right, where, it's almost like the old Marcus comes back, and there's a tiniest, most subtle facial change. And he goes, "Lawrence, is it you?" or something like that. And it's, oh my goodness, it's heartbreaking. Because again, Lawrence, being this gentle, compassionate soul, latches onto that and thinks that he can rescue his brother. But it's gone within an instant. It's not dragged out, it's gone. Marcus turns, and then that's the end. That's the end of Lawrence. So that's great. We've talked about Gabriel Wolfe, but we've also got, interestingly, George Tovey, who's not a name that I was familiar with, apart from the surname. I thought that rings a bell, and I looked it up, and actually, it is who I thought it was. He played the poacher, and he was the father of Roberta Tovey, who played young Susan in the Peter Cushing Doctor Who and the Daleks movies. So there's an interesting little link. Peter Copley was Doctor... Dr. Warlock. I love that name, Dr. Warlock.
That's a great
Who has
name,
a surname like Warlock? Yeah. Only in Hammer Horror and Doctor Who would anything like that happen, But then we've got if you and here's a name I kind of latched onto. So Vic Tablian, who played Ahmed, right? Now Ahmed was in it for 2 seconds at the start of episode one, right? When Marcus Garman opens the tomb and finds, the sort of baleful green light of Sutek and all that kind of thing. And he's the Egyptian guy who kind of runs away screaming in the end of it. And apparently he was also in Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is interesting. Played a deadly Peruvian in the opening sequence. And then also in the same film, he was the guy with the monkey and the patch with the, with the dates. So I didn't know that. A little thing there. So, but it is brilliantly cast, actually. And I think, everyone behind the scenes done, as I forgot who it was who tweeted that in, but I totally agree. They did a cracking good job, So, so some feedback from our Facebook friends.
Yeah.
And again, this probably got us the most hits we've ever had on a single Facebook post ever.
I think so. Look it up. It is
a popular story. Well, I made a note here, right? So on our page, actually, I didn't write on how many it got.
Yeah, it gets a bit.
But it got a few.
Complicated, doesn't it? Because we post it, then it gets shared to various groups.
Yeah.
And then,
so we're
comments come in, and you're like,
So one of the groups we're in is Doctor Who Classic Infinity. You are a brilliant group. Yeah. You know, I love really those guys. Good, one of the best moderated groups I think we've been involved in. So that got 43 comments, and then just Doctor Who. This Facebook is just Doctor Who. They must have got there first before anybody else. So they said, yeah, Doctor Who, that's it. You know, so, so we've got 65 comments on that, so I'm not going to read all those out, but I'll read a few. So from our own page, we had Philip Cregan, who's contributed a lot, actually. Some really good comments.
Yeah.
So Philip Cregan says, it's very good, but has never been an absolute favourite of mine. I found season 14 more lived up to the hype. That's the season after this one. So apart from Morbius, which is a massive favourite, I enjoyed but wasn't blown away by season 13. Why? It's tricky to answer, says Philip. Certainly watching it for the first time at Sunday lunchtimes of BBC Two didn't help. Maybe that's the thing as well. Watch it during the day, in the afternoon. Maybe it's a tea time, wintry, autumnal kind of spooky horror, you know, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that's thing. Eleanor Jody Alashovsky says, oh my goodness, always has been and always will be an all-time favourite. And Michael Donithorne agrees by saying, love this story. So a few from Doctor Who Classic Infinity. So Andrew Green says, is it an entertaining story? Yes. Is it an all-time classic? No. And then he go on, it's a little bit negative here. I thought, where's this coming from? But Andrew goes on to say, it's a dreadfully written story with a multitude of plot holes, nonsensical set pieces, and a complete lack of regard for the laws of physics. I agree with some of that. I don't think it's dreadfully written. I think it was written the best it could be, but it's certainly not dreadful. However, says Andrew, the cast are all fantastic. It's well directed and looks and sounds great with some terrific set pieces, which I totally agree with. Graham J. Burton says it's still one of the ultimate adventures from start to finish. Perfect cast. Andrew Beer says, I watched it last night. A great story. Proper Hinchcliffe. Gothic horror. Always a joy to see Michael Sheard as well. Steve Eccles says, one of the greatest stories in my top five Tom Baker stories. And Tom's the best classic doctor, says Steve. Sutek, the voice of a brilliant sinister entrapped. It actually says sister, but I think it's supposed to be sinister. Entrapped Destroyer. He has great lines. And then says, don't be too hard on sci-fi visuals. It was 50 years ago. True. It was 50 years ago, and life was very different pre-Star Wars. So there's a few others which are the same. And this one here from Dave Brock, actually. So Groovy Robo Mummies, nice Doc and Sarah banter, rounded characters, fast pace, screaming deaths, and nice horror touches. I think, yeah, it is. Part one is quite fast-paced. I think part two and three, they sort of lag, but, you know. The final takedown of Sutek is a nonsense waffle-filled anti-climax. but the rest is excellent and worthy of the love fans get it. And then Steve Parker says, this is brilliant timing, so Steve Parker says, I just got done watching this one. Wow. It's a near-perfect story that goes from horror pastiche through to out-there science fiction with a glance into alternate reality and the resolution even hinging on actual physics. Yeah, kind of, but don't look too deeply in that. There's not a bad performance, even if none of the guest cast can make it out of the serial. The script is perfect, and the production values are high. 11 out of 10. And then I just have to mention a couple from the Doctor Who group. Teresa Bacon, as we'll talk about up to the minute. So I looked at these just before we came online for the podcast, and Teresa Bacon says, well, it's not my favourite, not even my favourite with Tom Baker. To which I said, well, what is your favourite then? Come on, what's your favourite Tom Baker? And then she responded by saying, Talons When Trying, legendary, classic, like it. Yeah. And then she just wrote in, just before we were about to go live on this, she said, maybe I spoke too soon. I'm now watching The Invisible Enemy, presumably for the first time, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I have not seen this series before, and I'm loving the introduction of K-9. Which is great. And Perry Lloyd says, absolutely love this story, if only because my daughter loves it. I think we had a few people on here who said they're watching with their sort of children and grandchildren, and you know, the younger kids were loving it, weren't they? There was another one. Where is it? Oh, there we go. Laura Mead, who says, my six-year-old grandson and I watched this recently. He loves it and keeps asking if we can watch the show with the robot mummies again.
Oh, yeah.
Makes my heart happy. Because I think you replied to that one, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, it's great because, fun enough, last weekend I actually... watched Avatar Way of Water with Ethan, and
did you? Yeah,
we watched it over about three nights, and I was forced to watch it in the first bit.
So you couldn't take the full 3.5 hours in one go then, no?
Yeah, it wasn't going to happen. And then we watched the next night, and actually at one point he went, "Oh, I love this." And he reacted brilliantly to it, you know, like when... you know, there was sort of a danger and stuff. Oh, are they going to be okay? What's going to happen? Is he going to live? And I was saying, just got to watch him and find out.
Yeah.
You know, he got scared at one point, and you know, when the fighting all kicks off at then, he was going, "Yeah, Jay, go!" And I thought, that is pure.
That's what you want, isn't it?
That's what goes on in my head, you know, when I watch stuff. But you know, I have to be respectable. Like, you know, I can't. You know, or responsible, I should say. I can't stand up and you know, shout out.
When I went to see the first
Thor, and this wasn't me, but the bit where Thor flies through the air and near the beginning, and he goes straight through the ice monster's gob and comes out the back of his head. Some bloke in the cinema went, "Fuck yeah!" really loudly.
Fuck yeah!
and we finished Whitewater. And then Ethan said to me the next day, he said, "Can we watch Avatar, the first one?" And I said, "Well, you've seen it." He said, "Well, I don't remember it. You know, can I watch it again?" And we started watching it, and he said, "Is that Jake at the beginning?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "He's human." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What?" And he'd forgotten completely, you know, what happened. So, you know, he got to experience all that again.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, for me, it was great that, you know, he actually, you know, taken an interest in it. He was asking what the creature's called, what are they, who's that, and you know, really. So that was brilliant. So yeah, like that Facebook comment, it's great when they you know, want to take a bit of an interest in things.
Yeah,
and you know, recently I watched The Star Beast with the kids, and you know, they really enjoyed it. And I was happened to be looking at a photo of the toys that were revealed at the toy fair recently, and there was the Wraith Warrior figure, and Phoebe was next to me, and she looked at my phone and she said, "Oh, I know that, don't I? I've seen that in Doctor Who." And I thought, God, you remembered that well. You only seen it once a little while ago, but obviously its design and stuff stood out to her, you know. So that was good. Yeah.
And that's it, isn't it? You know, we sometimes forget those things when we become grizzled old adults. Although, just to close this off, I have to say, repeat what I said at the beginning, that when I watched this the most recent time, just before Christmas, and I literally did one story per Doctor over a series of weeks, trying to find the most Christmassy sort of episodes or stories that kind of, you know, either needed to watch again or were rich in atmosphere and evoked a certain something. So Pyramids of Mars I watched, and I did love it, you know. I enjoyed it the most I'd ever since, and I have seen it a lot of times, and this is the first time I'd watched it and just thought, it's just great. You know, regardless of what you might think, whether this works, that doesn't work, that could have been better or whatever, or I'm not buying this, I'm not buying that.
Yeah, you can get bogged down at that or just enjoy it.
Yeah, you can. I mean, I was hoping to end on a happy note, actually, on that, but I just have to point out, because another thing that used to irritate me with the story, probably still does, is the riddle sequence at the end. You know, when they go through the pyramid on Mars, the and they solve and stuff, the troubles. I mean, that's where that moment comes in, that Marx Brother improv that you were talking about a few minutes back. And there's a few years before that, there was Death to the Daleks. And in my head, which has a very similar sequence in that story, right? The Doctor has to solve a whole load of logic puzzles working his way through an alien city. And then, of course, you got the end of the Hand of Fear, which I think doesn't quite do that, but still has, you know, the Doctor and companions walking through an alien environment trying to overcome various obstacles which are put there to kind of keep them from doing what they need to do. So it's all of that gets confused in my head, and I can never remember which one's which. But I must admit, actually, the one in Pyramids wasn't too bad, except where Sarah Jane says it's just like the Dalek City on Exelon, and she wasn't actually in. She was in the story, but she didn't go in that city, so how would she come?
Well, he must have
no told. One would remember. No one really bothers about that. You know, that's all fine. But I think apparently, I think one of the puzzles, at least, Philip Inchcliffe had a go at, and, you know, he kind of put it in there, and it goes back to a Franz Kafka story, The Castle, which is and I read The Castle years ago, and I can't think of a moment where that occurred, but I need to go back and read it now just to find it, because that's what this sort of stuff does to me. But that's a great story, and I love the idea that that contributes, you know, something like Kafka contributes to the source material, because, you know, it is really derivative, like I said, but, you know, it's having such good fun in borrowing these tropes and messing around and throwing them into the Doctor Who universe with, you know, I'd like to think with wild abandon, but actually getting an idea of the kind of stresses that Robert Holmes was under trying to get this thing written. Wild abandon probably doesn't describe it, probably more like sheer desperation to get something written and made, you know, so they can make a bloody TV program out of this to keep everyone happy. So, you know, kudos to the guys, because they pulled some absolute crackers out of the bag under some incredible circumstances. They always do. I think, you know, even recently when we were talking to Chris Chibnall, he's telling us about what it's like behind the scenes.
Even the Daleks and stuff,
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, back in the 70s, we've started to have strikes. We've got Mary Whitehouse coming into this. You know, she's not really commenting on this one, I think, but she's, you know, I think this is when they started to maybe take notice. Yeah. You know, and I think the questions have been raised in the Daily Mail and stuff, like, you know, Tea Time Terror for Tots and stuff like that. Probably, I think it was mostly the year after this, but I'm sure it would have started here, you know, with the Brain of Morbius, because I think maybe Robert Holmes goes a little bit far, possibly. But I love that blend, as someone has said, you know, that perfect blend of gothic horror and sci-fi. You know, I don't think it happens in any other period in Doctor Who's history to quite the extent that it happened here. You know, we still get one or two stories, like you said, with Hyde and Villa Diodati, but they're kind of one-offs in amongst a load of other different styled stories. This was a period of Doctor Who where we had almost two seasons worth of back-to-back unadulterated classic gothic horror masterpieces. You know, yes, full of flaws, maybe not for everybody, but for a generation of people, and even today, they still leave an indelible mark, and in many ways represent exactly, frame by frame, tick box by tick box, exactly what Doctor Who is about and the power it has to change and move people and excite and inspire and terrify them.
Which is what it should do. So thanks for listening, everyone, and to everyone who contributed comments and...
yes, thank you, all of
you. Thank you so much. All
10,000 of you.
Please come back and do more. So we'll be back soon with perhaps another episode review. We also need to start our Death of Clara series, which we were talking about before we started recording. We thought it might be one episode, but it might be more. We'll have to see how we go. And soon we'll have our episodes with Al Dwyer and Ed Barnett Ward coming out about action figures as well. So look out for those soon. So
if you're listening to this next year,
well, they've been out gone.
There, so look through the back.
Go back. Yeah, good point.
And
find it. Timey-wimey.
So, that's the point, mate. We've been doing this for like nearly two and a bit years.
Yeah.
Two and a bit years on this, but we did the Marvel podcast.
And we did our Marvel one,
It's 3 years.
So, yes, it's been a couple of years overall,
You think we know what we're doing by now, wouldn't
you? Yeah, yeah. Well, apparently most people, most podcasts die after 7 episodes, but not
And we
us.
Do these weekly, mate, as well, so we've been doing this.
Yeah.
And we're still talking to each other, and so that's
all
good.
And yeah, we're going out to a night at the theatre soon as well.
Yeah,
so
that's going
to
be fun.
Yeah, that's going to be good, yeah. So, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Who Corner to Corner, TTFN.
That's all for now.